lived a long uphill struggle. I think if psychotherapy is like chipping away at the rock face of your unconscious, weak bone, banging the old mallet, getting a few rocks, chucking them out, you work your way through until you've actually driven a passage right the way through to where you have to be. Somewhere around, I shouldn't be telling you this, but somewhere around 4 years in, the therapist said to me, he was an American, he said, "Have you ever taken LSD?" I said, "No." "Do you consider it?" I said, "Yes." And he'd been involved in the States in the 60s with some of the clinical trials of LSD, and still had some samples, which, you know, were in his deep freeze and had lasted a long time. And we did it. I went to his therapy office one Saturday, 9 a.m. Brought the tab of acid. It took about an hour, hour and a bit to come on. I'd spent the whole day there, with him sitting in his chair with taking notes, and me writhing about on the floor, completely tripping out of my mind. And all I can say is, if therapy is like chipping away at the unconscious with a hammer and chisel to work your way, this is a stick of dynamite that you put in there. I mean, really, I can't imagine how people take acid recreationally and go out dancing on it these days. I mean, it must be a weaker form of acid, is the only thing I can think, because there's no way I could have functioned in a public situation there. But maybe today's young people are tougher. It can wreak terrible damage. I mean, it is a stick of dynamite, so you hold the thing when it goes off, it kills you. Sure, you can easily jump off the edge of a building when you're tripping. And, you know, if any of you are thinking about doing it, do not do it alone. Whatever you do, you know, you have to have a pilot there with you, really. Or at least somebody to monitor your position by, because otherwise you could just drift off into somewhere completely different. But I did this 3 times in the course of the 10-year therapy, and each time it would blow this huge sort of pile of rubble into the path that we were chipping. And you spend 6 months of therapy moving the bits away and sort of looking, what have we got here? And clearing it away. But it did move things on quite drastically. And I would say to you, beware of people who say drugs are bad. We're against drugs. No, because it seems to me that when people say drugs are bad, they discount the drug of alcohol out of that equation. They discount the drug of tobacco out of that equation. And I've, in all seriousness, had teenage Belgian pop fans coming up to me with very earnest badges on, say, you know, Ghent against drugs, at a pop festival sponsored by Marlboro, at which they're giving out free samples to the kids. And all the programs and tickets have Marlboro all over them. And these kids are worried about heroin. The percentage of people that are going to die from heroin in Ghent compared to the percentage of people in a country where smoking is still very socially acceptable and on the increase among young people, you know, so getting into sermon mode very easily. Anyway, all I say is, you know, drugs are not necessarily uniformly bad. I'm not saying let's take everything and get completely out of our heads all the time either, but that there's no such thing inherently as bad, except that you can say certain things are highly addictive, certain things will lead to these physical conditions, and overuse of most things will lead to certain physical conditions. Acid, for me, was helpful. And the key point in the therapy was halfway through, on one of these trips, I saw, it's like a very intense dream, that but you're still awake while it's going on. And I was a young knight in armour. My father's name is Arthur. And as a metaphor, you know, a knight in armour, sort of encased in this sort of protective armour that sort of stops you from actually moving properly and completely encloses you and restricts you, was pretty good. Old King Arthur, this terrible, huge, intimidating figure, was demanding that I swear allegiance and kiss the ring on his finger and swear allegiance to the young knight, to the old king. And I was fighting him, I was going, no way, you know, struggling. And as I struggled, I had the sense that I had struggled for so long doing this, and I was just weary and sick to my bones, constantly battling the fucking Great King. And I just threw down the sword. I was like, no, I'm not going to fight. I'll kiss the ring, whatever you like. I can't be bothered with it. I'll kneel down, I'll do that. Doesn't matter. And as soon as I did that, the king disappeared into dust, crumbled away, and was gone. There was no adversary. The only thing to give it life was my struggle. For as long as I fought it, it was there and it could never be beaten. As I stopped fighting it, there was nothing to fight. It's the most extraordinary thing. And I wrote to my dad, and I said, I'm really sorry for the pain that must have caused you over the years. And I'm ashamed of the fact that I've been rebelling against you in a completely bogus rebellion, because I've always known that you're like a steadfast human being who would never throw me out, and that I could always come back like the prodigal son any time and be welcomed back in with the fatted calf, you know. So what kind of rebellion is that? You know, it was completely bogus, and I'm really sorry to have pained you and caused you hurt, and you know, I want you to know that I love you. And he wrote back this most brilliant letter. The letter I thought he would never write, ever. He said, don't worry about the past. He said, you know, sons have their roles, fathers have theirs. He said, I want you to know that I'm pretty proud of you for going your own way. And despite all my discouragement, in your chosen field of endeavour, and doing well in it, and I boast about you pretty shamelessly. I love you. I never thought in all my born days that my dad would ever say he was proud of me, least of all for having gone and done the hated pop music. It's fantastic. And I think losing that burden then enabled me to finish the rest of the therapy, which just meant that I could actually relate to a human being. Up to that point, I hadn't been able to cohabit with anyone for any length of time without going crazy about losing my personal space. Typical. But I was able to actually drop the barriers and really open up and enjoy other people. And you know, still learning to do that, I suppose, at this advanced age. I think you never stop learning and growing and trying to expand your horizons. So, the other thing that was going on alongside all this was that about 2 years, I was about 32, at a gay switchboard benefit. And I met this girl who was roadieing for one of the lesbian acts on there, who was her girlfriend. I say girl because she was 18, 19 or something. Maybe a little older. And I've got to sort of own up here about being gay, because one of the things is that being gay actually is easier in many ways, for like getting off with people, finding partners, having sex. Although you've only got a 1 in 20 chance that the person you fancy is even eligible, when you are male, you can cope with sex divorced from personality. I mean, it's perfectly possible to have great sex with somebody you don't even know the name of. And I'm told that women find that harder, or are less interested in that. But it means that when you get gay relationships, two men together, whatever the characteristics of men are, is cubed. I mean, it's just like multiplies. So you're sitting on a tube train, for instance, and a man sitting opposite you smiles, and you get talking. The chances of you ending up in bed together within 24 hours are better than 50-50. If you've talked for more than 5 minutes, it's better than 50-50. Same thing happens between a man and a woman. Those odds are nothing like 50-50. You know? And there's a whole load of stuff. And again, with men, people say, well, how do you know? You know, how do you know who to make chances at? Well, if you're looking and the other person looks straight back and looks you in the eye, you know. It's called gaydar. Now, what was strange about this woman was that she had it. So I looked at her and she looked at me. Straight back. You want to make something of it? And we didn't, you know, for about 4 years, something like that. We just became part of the same circle of friends. But I was drawn to her because she didn't behave like most of the other women I'd met. And I think the fact that she doesn't wear makeup, you know, sort of goes around in jeans and motorcycle boots and a t-shirt most of the time, and it's just like one of the guys, really. I mean, it meant all that kind of intimidating stuff of, you know, fully laced knickers and stuff. Very alien, you know. Oh, none of that. Oh, bras. Oh, no bras. She's never worn a bra in her life. It somehow, it meant that one New Year's Eve party where her boyfriend was drunk in the bedroom and my boyfriend was throwing a scene in the kitchen, we had a New Year's kiss. And it kind of lasted and lasted until it got actually embarrassing for the other people in the room. And at that point, we knew that something's going to happen. We became each other's bit of fluff on the side from our respective boyfriends. and then, you know, I guess something like 5 or 6 years after we'd first met, we both broke up with our respective boyfriends. And started seeing each other regularly, and after a while the journey from my house to her house to my house, and we both stayed a night there and we stayed a night there, and it all got a bit much, and we just moved in. And after about a year of living together, basically loving the woman more every, you know, the longer time goes by, which has continued to happen, I was so horribly soppy and stuff. And I'm not a huge romantic, and I don't subscribe to Mills and Boone. But it's just the way it is. It's not kind of hearts and flowers kind of love. We just get closer to somebody the longer you can do, the longer you live with them. And the more intimate you become, the more you let the barriers down. And obviously, the more vulnerable you become at the same time, which is the downside of it. But we were getting slowly kind of drawn into this, and this is when the Sunday People heard about the rumour and sort of plastered it all over their bloody paper. And Trotters wants to become a character in the tabloids. You know, you begin to inhabit their demonology of who exists and who you can write stories about. And once they get their hooks into you, it's very hard to get them out of it. And they continue to write bollocks about us. And other papers picked up on it as well. And then they heard that my partner was pregnant and wrote a story about how he's got his girlfriend pregnant. He's made her pregnant. And then when the kid was born, they said, "We want photos." I said, no, you don't understand. We've got a very good source that's given us a very good story about you people. So we're going to print it this Sunday unless you give us photos. You won't like it. And we're going to press unless we have photos this week. What can you do? What can you do? We go to the press council, they say we can't do anything until they've printed something, mate. So the only thing we could do was have baby photos taken to write a full 4-page account of our relationship. You know, which is nobody's bloody business. Nobody's at all, except Alan. And hand it out to whoever bloody wanted it the day before the Sunday People went to press despite their story. With the result, the page three of the Sun that Saturday had the statutory, or statuesque, top his pin up, and me cuddling my son. And you know, the inevitable glad to be dad headline and. But the result is that there's me talking to these scummy papers that I loathe and despise with my picture in them. And there's all my gay friends going, what the fuck is he on about? What's he trying to do here? You know, what he does, you know, if he wants to have babies, that's his own fault. Why does he have to make such a big song and dance about it? And in a sense, I've never been forgiven by the gay community. Because factoids have a life of their own. And somebody once called the press cutters libraries the more great mausoleum of embalmed lies. And they are. Because anytime anybody writes any story promoting some record that I'm making, they'll do an interview for 2 hours about the music and 2 minutes about the family, and it's the 2 minutes about the family that gets in there. And if they do any research, they look it up in the libraries, and there's all this stories of rubbish that some scumbag on the Sunday People saw fit to make up in 1988. And however many retractions or, you know, setting the record straight you make, the thing has a much bigger life. You know, David Mellor never did that thing with a football kit, but he still is the Chelsea strip man. And will always be. There's nothing, any number of times he's refuted them and said, yes, I did have sex with her, but we didn't do that. That was just made up of faith. But it's just become fact. And so you can't actually get out of it. And it's a source of great regret, really, because those people have an agenda which is straight is better than gay. Man plus woman is better than man plus man. Which is no way my agenda, because I know different. It was purely an accident that the person I fell in love with happened to be the wrong sex. Life would have been so much simpler, if it had been a man. But it wasn't. And I guess it's, you know, karma coming around to get you. And if you make enough of sort of sticking your neck out in a song and dance, literally a song and dance about it, about something like that, then the way fate comes round to sort of kick you up the bottom is sort of, what's the one thing that would really humiliate him? Yeah. But it happened, you know, and if it's just annoying that they use my life as fodder to further an agenda which is completely against what I've spent my life trying to sort of to do and to work at. So don't believe everything you read in the papers. Are there any questions?
Most of us, when we're dealing with our insanity, do it in private because we're not famous people.
Yeah.
I'm really just kind of trying. What I'm getting at is that being in the public eye.
Yeah.
Did that help to fuel your insanity?
It certainly doesn't help. You're, you know, Iggy Pop talked about growing up in public and. I think the prurient interest of other people and the distortion of whatever happens doesn't help. It's the great thing about a therapeutic relationship, the one-to-one with a therapist, a good therapist, is they don't bring any, they're like that blank screen. They're sitting in the chair in the office, in the therapy office. You're sitting here talking to them. But they're not throwing any pictures of their own onto the screen. Every other relationship you're in with anyone they've got their own stuff they're bringing to bear on it. You never know for sure where you stop and they begin, and how much is your neurosis and how much is their neurosis. Who's being reasonable? You can't know. In therapy, just 1 hour, two or three times a week, you've got that. And you talk. You get angry. That's because you're angry, not because they've wound you up. No, that's... So, you can't know what the situation is when it's public, particularly, and when that extra bit of, you know, pot stirring is going on. Obviously, I mean, I would like to be back in the public eye on the television all the time, having hit records. Otherwise, I wouldn't make records if I didn't want people to buy them in large quantities. But I have to say that the fact that they don't sell in significantly large quantities compared to Michael Jackson or compared to just about anybody, actually. that does have its compensations. So I'm not trying to say, fame and fortune, no thank you. I'm working actively towards having a third burst of fame and fortune in the 90s, but while that doesn't happen, the great compensations are anonymity and being grounded, doing my own laundry, hanging out with things on the line, changing my son's nappies when he was little, taking him to school now, putting him to bed, going to Sainsbury's, doing the shopping, and not being hassled. You're just a bloke in Sainsbury's, going around Sainsbury's pushing his trolley. At the school, the parents don't know me as Tom Robinson. I'm just Alexander's daddy. But they don't know what I do for a living. And it's not like I keep it a secret, but it's just not an issue. And it's so good to have a life outside of what you do for a living, which it's very easy not to have when that consumes 24 hours, 7 days a week. 24/7, as they say. So and the fame thing, I mean, it's God knows what it's like for the Elton Johns in this world to have to cope with. I mean, I think when he went into drug rehab, I heard he went to this place in Chicago and hated it, and after a week decided to check out and go back to London, but he didn't know how to book a plane ticket. So he had to stay. You know, he'd never ironed a shirt in his life before. It's a very strange existence. You go. But that isn't the fault of the people it happens to, it's just the nature of what happens. Because after 2468 Motorway got into the charts, I went back to my favourite old CD gay pub in King's Cross on a Friday night to just hang out again and get a bit of normality back after the madness had been going on. There was nowhere to go. There was no hiding place. I went in there. Suddenly, half the people are much friendlier than they'd ever been before. it's really great. You know, people didn't give you the time of day before. And then the other half of the people were like, slumming it, are we now? Come back to sort of mix with us ordinary people. And going out to the McDonald's afterwards for a hamburger, there's a table of people at the other table said, look at him trying to pretend he's Mr. Normal, that's one of the people there eating his hamburger. No, I'm just eating the same hamburger I ate for the last 5 years, but the perception changes. People project. You are the blank screen, suddenly. And the recipient of all kinds of evil, sort of twisted, neurotic things. The more famous you get, the more likely you are to get that. So again, I'm very thankful that I don't get the kind of bizarre hate mail and weird fan letters that people get when they're really famous. So there are big compensations for not being in the public eye.
Very nice to you again. Thank you for sharing yourself. I'd like one of you to comment on what I'm going to say. 34 years ago, when I first trained as a Samaritan in London, we were given statistics that about 48% of gay people were genetically gay, and about 51% were circumstantial. I was one of the earlier Samaritans who had talked to non-Samaritan groups about Samaritan work and about the awareness of sexuality differences. Also bearing in mind that most children at some stage have gone through a sort of feeling of either a girl, a crush on another, a boy, a hero worship. How do you think that statistic stands up? Might it have changed?
Well, the only place I had any kind of definite experience to be able to talk about that was at Finchley Manor, where there were as I say, 40 or 50 youths of highly at the peak of their sexual kind of charge, cooped up together in close quarters in the middle of the country. And what was interesting there was, out of those 50, I'd say maybe 6 were gay, for sure. I was one of them. I mean, they who only fancied boys and who had no other particular sexual interest and who remained that way for the whole of their stay there. Then I would say there were probably 10 who were heterosexual. Definitely heterosexual. And you could tell they were heterosexual because if you made a pass at them, they laughed. The other, what have you, 74%, whatever it was, the other ones, if you made a pass at them and they had never done anything with another guy, they'd be, oh, you're about to get the wall, chaps, no way, you know, forget it. Ugh, queer. They were the ones who, like, within 6 months would actually have a little thing themselves and try it out. Most of the boys there, at some point in an average 3-year stay, would actually have some kind of homosexual experience. And it might last one night, it might last 3 months, 6 months, 9 months maybe, but it was the famous passing phase. They had that potential, but it wasn't their ultimate destination, if you like. So, Kinsey, I mean, who is largely discredited, but for what it's worth, the Kinsey report did suggest that there was a sliding scale of 1 to 10, you know, where you had completely heterosexual on one side, completely homosexual on the other, and everybody else was somewhere between 2 and 9. And that all I'd add to that is that probably in the course of a lifetime, where you are on that scale may slide around in either direction at any point. That's all I know. Yes.
That being said, how responsible, if you're the song that you sang last night, which is going to be released as a single, which I thought was superb, and I'm sure it will be, how responsible do you feel for that middle line, in that they would then see you as the role model? Would you see that you making a stance is going to have any reaction for them?
I'm very wary about role models and how much actual physical change they have. When we worked for Rock Against Racism, I don't think that National Front skinheads used to come to the Rock Against Racism concert, see the light and go away converted and grow their hair. No. And at the height of that first 15 minutes of fame, my band played 2 nights at Hammersmith Odeon, sold out, that's 8,000 people, and everybody sang, "Sing if you're glad to be gay," like that, you know, except for a few people who are obviously closeted gays who were going, because the well-adjusted heterosexuals were singing because it was like a hit song, and the gay, well-adjusted gays and lesbians were singing because it was a hit song and it meant something, and the only ones who didn't were the ones who had some kind of issue with it. But I don't know how much that actually affected the social fabric of the society. Because while this was going on, the second night, I thought, no, the world hasn't changed as much in 9 months. It hasn't, really. And I stopped the song, mid-song, went over and kissed the keyboard player on the lips, just to see what would happen. He quite liked it, actually. But this shockwave of revulsion ran through the audience. And a friend of mine was at the back of the theatre and said that there were these 2 beer boys in the row in front of him who would be going, "Sing if you're glad to be gay!" And one of them turned to the other and actually said, "You know what, I'm having these geezers a bend." Role model, schmoll model.
Tom, you've related a number of crises in your life, and
yes,
gone through those, and it's obviously a lot of people experience that one form or another. And you're moving on. But there's a very strong message in the music that you played. Do you ever see moving on in your music in regard to that message?
Well, hopefully, you know, in the course of 12, 13 albums, it has moved. Because you try to refine what it is you do. And having written Sing If You're Glad To Be Gay, you can't then write Glad To Be Gay Part 2 or Glad To Be Gay Strikes Back. The return of Glad To Be Gay. Son of Glad To Be Gay. Glad To Be Gay 4. So basically, what I then tried to do, certainly on that particular front, was to then write songs that were just like ordinary songs about everyday life, love songs, what have you, from the perspective of a gay man, so that those songs that I spoke about, where you'd hear things and they were almost about you, I was trying to write just sort of everyday songs, just about daily life and love and heartache and loss and hopefully happiness. Over the course of those 12 albums, that's what I've done. But the shift, I think, largely is that it's not just the gay front, because you can't ask for freedom and liberation and equality of treatment and equality of opportunity for lesbians and gays if women don't get the equality of opportunity. And you can't ask for equality of opportunity for women and gays and lesbians who are both if people of colour are disadvantaged. It's all part of the same class. You can't separate off people's freedom. Either the society is free and equal, or it isn't. And that was the basic thing on which the Tom Robinson Band was initially predicated, and which we tried to put into the songs all the way down the line. As I say, there's songs like Power in the Darkness, The Winter of 79, and things which sort of set that out at the time. But again, you can't write part 2, part 3, part 4, part 5. And what I've tried to do with this latest batch of songs is take it into the personal area. Not, I got up and brushed my teeth this morning, but actually what makes people tick, and what makes me tick, and what makes your friends tick. And that's really what you people have to deal with every day in the front line, is the reality beneath the surface. You know, the surface of Brookside versus the dynamic of what's actually going on underneath. I mean, Brookside's a bad example because it does try to tackle that dynamic, but you know what I'm saying. Maybe the everyday reality of commercials, TV commercials, which, you know, 2.4 kids, the Oxo family, what have you. And I've tried to sort of work the songs, not consciously, but that's just the way that they've grown up this time around. They come out. So that's the shift, I guess. Partly it's an expression of, I mean, I say I'm not trying to set myself up here as somebody who's, you know, fantastically adjusted or any kind of role model at all, but it's partly a product of despair, because having believed in those ideals and seen them slowly or quickly eroded over the last 13, 14, 15 years by successive governments, and the whole culture that's grown up around that, and just seeing all your dreams and the things you hold dear and care about smashed down again and again and again. A new round of budget spending cuts. How terrific. Every year. You feel powerless. After a while, there's no point running the flag up the flagpole and saying, rally over here. Because everyone's too busy, like, watching their own asses and trying to cling on to the basics that they've got out there. No one's going to come out. You're not the Rockets racism rallies weren't the result of us holding the banner and people saying, "Oh God, isn't Tom great?" and going and supporting it. It was that we sensed, like the audience, that's what the mood of the times was, and that's what we felt, and luckily other people felt it too. So you run the flag up, and people go, oh right, over there. At Live Aid, it wasn't that Bob Geldof told us that we had to go and do something about Ethiopia. It was that we were all horrified by what was on the telly, and felt powerless, we couldn't do anything about it. Until Bob Geldof said, here, Live Aid, give us your money, now. And we had a focus. He didn't control us or lead us or anything. He just facilitated for us the groundswell of feeling that people had. So So you can't do that unless that groundswell is there and what you're feeling is what other people are feeling. So you try to write what you're what you're actually feeling at that time, which is, I can't do anything about the bloody political process. I joined the Labour Party, I vote Labour, what more? It's hard to see what more I can do. And, you know, enough reservations about what's going on with the Labour Party. Do I think that had if Neil Kinnock had won the last election, we'd have been in less shit than we are now? Frankly, no. But I would have welcomed it because it would have been different shit and it would have been, it would have been a change. All we can affect, for sure, is on the personal level. And for, I don't know about you, but for me, I just ended up going in there because you can at least help take away some of the anxiety and the unnecessary suffering by easing some of those knots for people. So that's really why I've kind of... It wasn't that conscious, but that, I think, is my rationale for doing what I did.
And I'm afraid on that note, I'm really sorry, but I think it's actually a very good note to end on. Tom, what can I say? Thank you. It was good for you.